All right, continuing in the 22nd chapter of the book of Acts, and we're on the questions, and we're getting ready to go into question number 9. All right, as we were going through the lesson last week, I had this picture of the model of the first century temple, generally speaking known as Herod's temple. Interestingly enough, in some of the literature, they refer to it as the Second Temple period. I'm not sure what that's supposed to mean. It's certainly the Second Temple after the temple was rebuilt. So maybe that's what they're talking about. But anyway, there were a couple of questions relating to this depiction. And some of them have to do with how many people can we get in here? And then also, what are these thingies right there? I found out about that. I'm not sure exactly how accurate some of these depictions are, but for example, here's a picture of the temple with some figures in it showing perhaps the scale of the temple area, showing that it's, as I mentioned last week, you could put hundreds of people just in the court of the Gentiles just on one side, and there's a court of the Gentiles on either side. You can see the little fence that I mentioned here. Going, it's supposed to be, somebody said it was like 4.5 feet tall or something like that. I have another picture right after this that's essentially the same but a little clearer. Notice, however, the person back here by the model. This, my understanding is that the one that was at the Holy Land Hotel, which has apparently been moved to some other place in Jerusalem now, it took quite an effort to do so. It's a 1/50th scale of Jerusalem. So that means that for each foot on here, it's 50 feet in actuality, right? So if you were to measure, for example, the door or something like that, and if it was so many inches, you could measure, you could multiply that by 50, and that's how many inches it would be or how many feet it would be. Anyway, a very, very large structure. I think I wasn't able to find any information about this, what was over here on the southern wall. But I know in some of the discussions about the original temple, Solomon's temple, that there were places for the priests to live and storage places for things like that. It's a big place. You can see some people inside the inner courtyard here, and then I think that you had to be one of the priests or whatever to go inside this other area. And I'm not sure whether the Holy of Holies is inside here or inside there. The next one, and of course last week I pointed out that this is what's referred to as the Antonia or the Antonia Fortress. That's where the soldiers would have come from. They had direct access into the court of the Gentiles through a gate right here. So that's how they were able to get down there so quickly. I guess it was Carolyn also asked, what are these things here that look like portals or doorways or something like that? Turns out that's exactly what they are. There is, on the south wall, a couple of gates that are now covered over. There's one with two arches, and there's one with three arches, though I'm thinking this is only showing two. But this one has three arches. And they're called Huldah's Gates. Does anybody recognize the name Huldah? It occurs twice in the Old Testament. She was the prophetess that King Josiah went to when they found, when they rebuilt or refurbished the temple in his time. Now, King Josiah was the great-grandson of Hezekiah. So to get to Josiah, what do we have to do? We have to go through Manasseh and Ammon, both bad kings. And Josiah was, I think he was the one that was 8 years old when he started to reign. And he had the priests go in and clean up the temple, fix it and repair it. And Shalom, the scribe, comes back and says, "Oh, and they delivered this here book here." Gave it to the king. You go, it's the book of the law. It's like, and that's all he says, is this book? Or he said a book. Wow, you didn't even know what the book was. But it's been a while. If we go from the end of Hezekiah's reign until the end of Josiah's reign, it's like 75 years. So it's a long time. I think that Hezekiah was familiar with the book of the law. But anyway, supposedly this is the the tomb of Huldah. Apparently, Huldah has a great following in Jewish traditional stories, the Mishnah and things like that, where they talk about things that are extra-biblical, quite extra-biblical, I might add. So it is supposed, though, that Huldah held a court down here on the south side of the temple, and that held court is just something. Just anyway, people would come to her and, you know, ask about things and stuff. That's what tradition says. My understanding is that the reason that these steps are wide here is that the people would go up these steps and they would go into the gates here, and then there was a kind of a hallway and then stairways leading up to the temple, which came out here. So you could go in there and get up into the Temple Mount from the south side that way. So it was, you had access there also. Not sure, I didn't look under this. I noticed there's a gateway here also. But there was one depiction that I saw. It showed arrows, you know, pointing this way, and then arrows pointing this way, like this is the way you go in, this way you go out. I wouldn't be surprised. So you'll never guess what the Muslims did with those. Walled them up. Diverted the passageways that are in there to the various ends of the Al-Aqsa Mosque that's up there now. And actually, some of the passageways that are in here now are used for mosques. And people can't really get in there to do much study right now because all the Muslims are in there. Bruce, you had your hand up?
Yeah, so that outer wall, is that, you know, to it goes all the way around? The outer wall from right here, the small one?
Yeah.
Not that wall. There was another wall in the other crucifixion.
Another wall? This thing?
Yeah.
No, I think that's just a decoration. Let me see. We got... This is just somebody's drawing from back in 1802 or whatever as to what he thought that Huldah's gates looked like. So you can see the three arches here and the two here that go in there, and you can get up there. It's a pretty tall wall goes up here. I assume that's the storage places and the priest quarters and stuff like that. I didn't see anything else depicting where that thing might go. That doesn't do anything for us. That's a little bit of the stuff that goes along with understanding what we're looking at when we look at some depictions of the temple in the first century. And as I mentioned last week, Herod the Great started building this temple in about 18 BC, and the temple continued in continuous construction, at least portions of it anyway, up until about 67 AD. So, as we mentioned, they had about 3 years to imbibe in the fully constructed temple before the Romans destroyed it. So, when you all go over there, you can see this depiction in it's the Israeli Museum of Antiquities or something now. Yes, sir?
Just as a sort of a footnote that really makes it impressive, Jesus said in Matthew 24 that not one stone would be left on another.
Yep. Yeah, all of them came. Whoops, pushed the wrong button. All of them came down. I mentioned last week that I thought that in this area down toward the base was where the western wall. It turns out it's over here where the Wailing Wall is down at the base. So that would actually have been more in this area here. That where the Western / Wailing Wall is right now. Chris.
So I'm a little confused. Does Herod build it and then the Romans destroyed it? Not one stone left on another. And then the Wailing Wall is all that's there. But she said that the Muslims walled up those doorways. Did they rebuild this?
It's all an archaeological excavation. I mean, none of it looks like this today.
But what the Muslims did, what, about 500-600 AD, they built a mosque on top of this.
So the stuff was still there at that time to a certain extent.
Because they never rebuilt it.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. It's supposed that the Dome of the Rock, which is the mosque that's there now, is the mountain on which Abraham sacrificed Isaac. Though there's no indication of that in the Old Testament, except for a few mentions about we went here and we went there type thing. It's difficult to identify, for example.
Go up to the mountains, I think, of Moriah.
Moriah, yeah.
Doesn't even specify their Jabus or...
Yeah. Another interesting note about the city of Jerusalem, I don't know, we don't see much of it here, but when David went to take possession of Jerusalem early in his career, as it were, when he moved to Jerusalem, he moved to the south side in what's called Ophel, and it's on sort of the south mound of the hill of Jerusalem, and that's where he established his city until they, in actuality, took the main part of Jerusalem away from the Jebusites. A lot of times you'll hear people, the New Testament and the Old Testament will talk about the city of David. And generally speaking, when they're talking about the city of David, they're talking about Ophel, the area that was on the south part of Jerusalem at David's initial capture of the city. It's interesting to note that the Mormons will talk to us about this and say, well, the Bible is wrong in saying that Jesus was born in Bethlehem, because it says that Jesus will be born in the city of David. And as everyone knows, the city of David is the south part of Jerusalem. And that's, as a matter of fact, I think their book indicates that Jesus was born in Jerusalem. And so it's difficult to argue with them, except for the fact that the Old Testament calls Bethlehem the city of David more times than any time that Ophel was mentioned as the city of David. So,
poor Magi went to the wrong place.
Yes, they did. They were led astray. Yep. That star just went the wrong direction, I guess. All right. So that's a good bit about some of the questions that we had last week about what's going on here. I thought that the size of the temple was rather impressive, assuming that these people are also 1/50th scale. So, you know, we were talking about how high are the doors. You know, you see how big this person is just in relationship to that opening into the temple proper. So there's some pretty big structures there. All right. Yes, Chris.
I just noticed the real person in the top of that picture.
Yep.
This is the actual model that we're talking about.
Right. Yeah. It's a giant back there. It's one of the Anakin. Yeah. Yeah, I know.
But
this is the real one. As a matter of fact, I think there's a person in this one, too.
Yeah. Well, the middle part is almost as tall as they are.
The what?
The middle part is almost as tall. They're right at the same height.
Yeah, that's what it looks like. Yeah. You go and just go to Google or something and type in Herod's Temple and look at the images. And you'll see a couple, because the people that give lectures at wherever this is now, they'll get inside the city and stand in there, and they'll walk around and tell you this is where this is and this is. And so there's a picture of somebody standing in the court of the Gentiles. So, yeah, it's a pretty big thing. And when you think about it, that it's 1 in 50, that's a big model.
Yeah, Randy.
But the doors are so tall, Chris would not have to stoop.
That's correct. You could run right through with reckless abandon.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Except for not being a Jew.
Well, there's that. Yeah.
Yes.
It dragged you out and beat you. Yes.
Minor detail.
Bruce.
You know, when you show those pictures, you know, it looks like there are walls all around the city.
There were.
Yeah.
But that's from the Hasmonean period. The time after the much after that. I don't know. Well, there had to be walls around the city. That's right. Yeah. As a matter of fact, you know, I mentioned last time that when we were talking about some of the destruction and rebuilding, and it said so and so built from this gate to that gate, that they're most likely talking about the gates of the city, not the gates of the temple. Right. Now, today, if you look at Jerusalem from the Mount of Olives, when you look down from here and look this way toward the Golden Gate, this is the exterior wall of both the temple and the city. But as you go around, the city goes further on out to the west, and so that's where there are further walls from the various other periods of Jerusalem's history, well after the time of the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. Yeah, so good point. Yeah, the walls out here also are part of the walls of the city, and some of them are still there, at least portions of them are. Back to the questions. So we're on the road to Damascus. Saul and the people that are with him are on their way to Damascus, having been dispatched by the high priest and the elders to go and speak gently to the Christians that are in Damascus. And I think we touched on this last week. So when the bright light shined, now how bright was the light? Brighter than the sunshine, yeah. The bright light shined and just knocked Paul right off his horse, right? So it says that Saul fell to the ground. Saul says, "Who are you, Lord?" Right? And what did Jesus say? No, that's not what he said right away. He said, "I am Jesus whom you persecute," right? And so from that we understand that if we're persecuting, and I asked this last week, who does the previous in the book of Acts, who does it say that Saul is persecuting?
The church.
Okay, so up until this time it doesn't say anything about persecuting Jesus, but Jesus himself says, "You're persecuting me." And so we understand that when we're persecuting the church, we're persecuting Jesus. Now, Saul asked another question. What did he ask after Jesus told him who he was? What shall I do? And what was he told, Bruce?
He was told to go to Damascus, and there he told what he was doing.
Exactly. Okay. So he asks, what shall I do? This is not an unfamiliar question in the New Testament. Many people have asked this and continue to ask it. And it's an important question to ask. Some expand it to say, what shall I do to be saved? Others say, just what do I need to do? And it's important that we understand that the Lord, in this instance, told Saul that he needed to go to Damascus and that he would receive further instructions about the things that he must do. Not that the things that he has options to do, but the things that the Lord is commanding him to do. Chris, were you going to put your hand up?
No matter what the question is, or how they phrase this type of question, it's always an acknowledgement of, I'm in trouble. I need to correct.
Yes, that's right.
However they phrase it.
Yeah. If we look at Acts, the second chapter, the first gospel sermon, and they say, men and brethren, what shall we do?
They know exactly the state they're in.
Yeah. They realize that they need to do something.
The fact that Saul of Tarsus would use the term Lord,
yes,
for Jesus is very significant.
Okay, yes. He does use the word Lord, which means in other translations also, doesn't that also mean master and
ruler,
master, things like that. So he acknowledges that the person to whom he is speaking is a higher authority than he. I don't think he's just being polite, given that he's just been blinded and has fallen to the ground and is speaking to somebody that he has not previously seen. And in the question that we had back here, I don't have it because it's in another. It says, we mentioned what qualifications did seeing the Lord give to Saul? Gave him the qualification of having seen the risen Messiah, right? The important thing for us to understand is that he's not just seeing a bright light. He sees Jesus. He says, what shall I do, Lord? And previous to that, Jesus says, I am Jesus who you're persecuting. He's not just seeing some bright light. Not only is he seeing a bright light, which blinds him, he sees Jesus, the resurrected Messiah. Bruce.
And also, in verse 10, you know, it gives you an understanding that when all this happened, that that Saul was knocked down. He told him to get up. Get up and rise. Get up and go.
I'm failing to find that. Oh, arise and go to Damascus, and there it shall be told thee all things that are appointed for thee to do. Okay? So, all of the things that will be appointed for you to do. So, Saul couldn't just lay there wallowing in his misery, or whatever we want to call it, in his blindness, but he had to get up and go to Damascus. Okay.
It seems like it's the same urgency when Ananias, you know, talked to him, and he immediately, the scale immediately fell from his eyes, and he arose and he was baptized. Immediately.
Yeah. It
shows urgency on what Saul needed to do. It helps us understand we need to be able to do that too.
Right. Yeah. We're not waiting for some other special event or, you know, a bunch of people to get together to do something. Or this, he's got a commandment from God, from Jesus, and that's what he's going to do. Right. This is obvious. What condition was Saul in following these events? He's blind. Okay. And I think he was a bit concerned, too, because for the next 3 days, what? No eating, right? So, and it wasn't until Ananias came to talk to him that I think Ananias actually mentioned that he should eat something at some time. Lynn?
I had two answers to that one.
Do you?
He was blinded, but the other one was he was still lost in his sins.
It's true. He was still lost in his sins. Until he did the things that God said he must do, then he was lost in his sins. And of course, that's borne out by the accounts that both Luke and Paul give of what happened in his discussion with Ananias, who said, arise and wash away your sins. I mean, if his sins were already taken away on the road to Damascus, then he didn't need to wash away his sins, did he? Bruce and Chris.
Yeah, and you know, like Liv was saying, you know, he didn't eat. And I've heard a lot of people take that out of context and say, well, you know, it's not that he didn't eat, he fasted. But the scripture doesn't tell you that. It, you know, just lets you know what his response was. He was blind and he didn't eat.
Yeah, I think it said he didn't either eat nor drink, right? Something like that. So, Chris.
I never thought of this before, but again, he's blind. But in Acts 26, as Paul's recounting this, it's while he's blind that the Lord tells him, I'm going to, your mission is going to be open the eyes
to
open their eyes so they can see the terms from darkness to light.
Okay.
It's kind of ironic that while he's blind, the Lord tells him, I'm going to have you open the eyes of other people.
Okay, this blind man is going to open the eyes of other people. Yeah. What things did Ananias do for Paul?
He gave Paul's blindness, number one, but he instructed him in the way of salvation.
Okay. So, we understand that Ananias was the agency through which Paul received his sight, or Saul received his sight again, and then also that he gave him instruction on what he needed to do. And why did he do that? Because the Lord said, go to Damascus and it'll be told you what to do. And we see earlier in the discussion with Ananias himself that that God tells him that Saul of Tarsus is there and you need to go talk to him and tell him what he needs to do. We already discussed this. Was Paul saved on the road to Damascus? And of course not. And we go to verse 16. Ananias says, wash away thy sins. If his sins had already been washed away, there's no reason for him to say this. So that's in verse 16 here. I didn't look up to see whether it was in the other accounts or not. I think it might be. All right.
Just made a note. Actually, I'm looking at Carolyn's notes because she's not here.
Ah, yes.
I stole her book. She made it, I guess, I remember Mickey saying this too, we're not lost because we're not baptized, but we're lost because we're sinners.
Yes.
So the thing about Paul, baptism definitely washed away his sins, but it's not like he wasn't required to do all the other things too. Confess Jesus Christ as Lord, repetitive sins and, you know, and go on and live a righteous life. It's just, that's the comment I want to make. It's just, it's a matter of obeying the commands of God that saves us.
Right.
And baptism is one of them.
One of those things, yeah. And as we went through that chart a couple of weeks ago and about all the conversions in the book of Acts, we see that it's not just one thing that saves you. It's a multitude of things, the things that God has commanded us. All of those things tell us about salvation. Lisa?
When he was talking with the Lord up there on the road, the Lord showed him, number one, you're wrong.
Mm-hmm.
He was shown his error. And he was told to go to Damascus and it would be told him what he would do. The Lord didn't tell him he was saved. He told him there was something he had to do.
Right.
So we can see in that verse right there, he was not saved.
No, that's true. Because there are still things that he needed to do. Jesus was very clear on that. Didn't say anything about salvation or whatever. Just go, it'll be told you what you need to do. Randy.
It's the same thing that was told that Cornelius, when Peter arrived, he said, we're here to hear you tell us what we need to do.
True, right, yes. Cornelius and his friends and family that were there, they were there for a purpose. And, of course, the angel had spoken to them, also telling them to send for Peter, and had told Peter to go preach the gospel. Number 13. I didn't even write an answer to that. Compare Luke's account of Paul's conversion and see what additional details are listed, 9:1 through 19. So if we go back to chapter 9, verse 1 and following. So 1 through 19 is half the chapter. Why is there a difference between chapter 9 and chapters 22 and 26? Melissa.
Well, first of all, this is Paul's account of what happened.
In 22, yeah.
So he didn't have knowledge of what went on with Ananias, number one. And so in chapter 9, we see the discussion of the Lord to Ananias, instructing Ananias to go to Paul, him not wanting to go, the Lord explaining why he's going to go and to go. And Paul didn't have that information. So we wouldn't have read that in this account.
Yeah.
And he's giving more of a brief discussion or explanation of what happened. So he didn't obviously see it necessary to talk about the fact that he didn't eat or drink for 3 days. So those are the two differences I found between the two. And it, because of his briefer explanation.
Sure. And because as we look at the book of Acts, we understand that it was written by Luke. And so when we're in chapter 9, we see Luke's account of what went on in the conversion of Saul of Tarsus. And so as this was told to him or inspired to him by the Holy Spirit. Then when we get to chapter 22 and chapter 26, we understand that now what we have is essentially a quotation of what Paul is saying to people about what happened to him. And as Melissa says, he's not going into the extreme detail that Luke did here in chapter 9, because, number one, Paul didn't have the details about what happened to with the discussion with Ananias previously. But also, all he's doing here is making his defense before the people and before court. And he's giving the essential elements of what needs to be discussed. So we have a full recitation of things from Luke in chapter 9, and then we have a recitation of his experience as an eyewitness, a person who did this, in chapters 22 and 26. And is there another chapter? Is it 24 also? No? Okay. I have to look to James, because he's the one that does that. So we have that one. So this Paul's account and Luke's account, they're not at odds with one another. They're just different because they're from different perspectives. Luke is looking at this from the perspective of inspiration of the Holy Spirit. Paul is looking at this from his actual own experiences. All right.
Very yeah. Much like the synoptic gospels in a way, because they intermesh. Each gospel writer gives slightly different bit of more information than the other, but they're all factual. It's just that you have to read them all to get the full picture.
Right, right. The full picture is found in the full Word of God. And so we're not looking at the synoptic gospels as being contradictory to one another, but additive. And so the same thing here, the difference between Acts chapter 9 and Acts chapter 22. It's interesting to note that as Paul goes through his recitation of things, it appears that, well, I was saved in Damascus and then just zipped right over to Jerusalem. I mean, that's all that it says, essentially. He gives no indication of a time frame here in verse 17. And it came to pass that when I had returned to Jerusalem, and while I prayed into the temple, I fell into a trance. There's no time frame given us here between verses 16 and 17. He's in Damascus, now he's in Jerusalem. But as Mickey points out here in Galatians, the first chapter, in verses 15 through 18, what actually do we have going on that... Once again, Paul, you might say, left out, but given that it's not important in the recitation of his story, we have additional detail, you might say, in Galatians chapter 1. So what do we got in Galatians chapter 1? What goes on there? So in Galatians chapter 1, verses 15 through 18, it says, starting in verse 15, "But when it was the good pleasure of God, who separated me even from my mother's womb and called me through his grace to reveal his son in me that I might preach him among the Gentiles, straightway I conferred not with flesh and blood, neither went I up to Jerusalem to them that were apostles before me, but I went away into Arabia. And again, I returned unto Damascus. Then after 3 years, I went up to Jerusalem to visit Cephas and tarried with him 15 days." So between verses 16 and 17? Yeah. Ananias says, "Now why tarriest thou? Arise and be baptized and wash away thy sins, calling on his name. And it came to pass that I had returned when I had returned to Jerusalem." So, in fact, he was in Damascus for a certain amount of time. Then he did what? Went to Arabia for an unknown period of time. Then he went what? Back to Damascus. And was in Damascus for what looks like an additional 3 years. Or perhaps 3 years total. And so we see the space between verses 16 and 17 is actually a minimum of 3 years. It's not just I was baptized and then hoofed it off to Jerusalem. That's not what happened. It was, and most people say it's 3 years because we look at that, we look at verse 18 in Galatians 1 and say, "Then after 3 years I went up to Jerusalem to visit Cephas." I look at that and say, well, after I got back to Damascus, then I stayed another 3 years and then went to Jerusalem. But we could look at that either way. What? Yeah. Go ahead, Melissa. Yeah.
Right, and if you go back to chapter 9, it gives you some details, too, again, in Luke's historical account of the events after his baptism. It talks about his days in Damascus and as he was growing and learning, and then the Jews plotting against him, and therefore he was sent away. And that's when he went to Arabia, basically.
Yeah.
It gives us a little bit more detail about that time.
That's true.
A little bit that we learn is more of an extended period when we get into Galatians. But again, a little bit more information.
Okay. Yeah, the one there in chapter 9 shows us that he was, after his baptism, he was in Damascus for an amount of time anyway. The people got to know him, apparently, and the Jews apparently got to know him well. So they were ready to kill him. Who's got the ESV or something that can read for us Galatians chapter 1, verse 18? Jenny, did you have that?
"Then after 3 years, I went up to Jerusalem to visit Cephas and remained with him 15 days."
Okay, that doesn't help at all. So, okay. All right, I thought maybe one of the other translations would, you know, say it some different way. But so it looks to me like in Damascus, in Arabia, back to Damascus, another 3 years, and off to Jerusalem. So I'm saying at least 3 years, maybe more. Yes, Randy.
And this is one of those small things that you would point to say that it's an indication that it is an inspired work? If man was making this up out of whole cloth, then Paul becomes converted there in Damascus. Why, the first thing you do is go back to Jerusalem. That's exactly what makes most logical sense from man's standpoint. That's not what God had him do.
Right. Once again, you know, our ways are not God's ways, and vice versa. Bruce, did you have your hand up?
Yeah, just, I've heard in denominations, you know, that after, in Acts chapter 9, once he got up and left and went to Jerusalem, he was taught 13 years. And I'm like, where do you get that from? But this explains everything what I hear from other divisions. And then, it's quite confusing when you start. Well, you got to go to school. You got to go to Lancaster Baptist because all of them.
Yeah. Men like to make up a lot because it helps them feel important, I think. Mm-hmm. What was Paul told to do relating to verse 21, and why relating to verse 18? So if we look at verse 21, what's that say? So in verse 17, it mentions that he went to Jerusalem, right? Verse 18, it said that he was in the temple and God spoke to him there and told him to get quickly out of Jerusalem. He responded to the Lord in verse 19, and he told him what he did about that he stood against Stephen. And so he's still making his defense now before the riotous crowd there in the courtyard of the temple. And so in verse 21, what did the Lord tell him to do?
He sends the Gentiles.
So what evil word did Paul use right there? Gentile. Yeah. That did not set well with the crowd that was beneath him there, under the steps or wherever they were. But the question is, though, what was Paul told to do? Told to go to the Gentiles, right? Verse 21. And why was he told to do that? Because they wouldn't accept him there. Yet Paul tells them here in these verses, 17 to 21, what he did to persecute Christians, and that he was sent by the chief priests and elders to go do this. But all he did was end with that word Gentile. That's all she wrote. As Mickey mentioned, he lost their attention at that point. Randy.
From a deeper level, not only did he mention the word Gentiles, but he's just said that I was spoken to by the Lord Jesus in the temple. They don't think he's the Lord. They don't think Jesus is God. But he's just said, I had a trance while I was in the temple, and Jesus told me this.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, they're thinking it's more than just the fact that he said the word Gentiles. They think he's blaspheming by calling Jesus Lord.
And as I mentioned, as I was listening to the recording from last week, I mentioned this, and nobody responded to it. But would Saul of Tarsus have listened to Paul of Tarsus?
No.
I don't think so. And they didn't. The ones that were just like him did not. And so we talked about the fact that having ears they hear not, and having eyes they see not. And Saul was the same way until, as we see, he saw the light. But, you know, the light that he saw was only a small part of that. Ananias had a part in it too. And there was a certain proclamation of the gospel that occurred in Damascus that we have no real words about here. But we understand that he had to learn about the fact that Jesus was Lord. All right, so he was told to go preach to the Gentiles because they wouldn't receive. They wouldn't listen to him in Jerusalem. And indeed, that's what they didn't do right there in front of it. Why would this audience be particularly critical of Paul's mission?
they still don't accept the Gentiles.
Right. So they're still prejudiced against the Gentiles. And if any of those Christians that were mentioned by the elders of the church previous to this account in chapter 21, if any of them were there, they were obviously still prejudiced against the Gentiles, apparently, it would seem. Though perhaps not to this degree of throwing dust in the air and trying to beat Paul to death. But there was some fixing that needed to be done with the people. And we see that it hadn't even occurred by Galatians, the second chapter, with Peter, right? Because Peter had to be admonished. Because he turned around from associating with the Gentiles in Antioch. And when Jews from Jerusalem came up, he turned away from the Gentiles and associated with the Jews only. So he had to be admonished by Paul at that time. So there was prejudice against the Gentiles. Now, so what was their immediate reaction to Paul's declaration of what his mission was? They recommenced their riot. That's what I put. They, you know, the chief captain felt that at this time I need to drag Paul all the way back into the barracks, because they're just, I don't know, they're going to come running up the stairs and kill him. You know, they started throwing dust in the air and ripping their garments again and yelling and screaming, and this was just an uncontrollable crowd. So he got out of there, the chief captain did. All right. So what did the chief captain command to be done? So he commanded to Paul to be taken into the barracks, and then what? That's right. He was going to politely interview him by tying him to a post and flogging him senseless. So, okay. So, commanded Paul be taken into the barracks and then examined by scourging. And then, what stopped him? Yeah. Paul's declaration of his Roman citizenship. All right. Explain why the discussion of Roman citizenship was so important. You may need to do this next. What time is it? What have we got? 30 seconds. All right. Now, explain why the discussion of being a Roman citizen was so important. It was a privilege to be a Roman citizen, and
it was against the law for a Roman citizen to be bound and or scourged without being actually convicted.
Convicted. Okay. All right. All right. We'll continue on with question 19 next week, and probably get into the 23rd chapter of the book of Acts. And then, as I mentioned, by the time that Mickey gets back, we should be through the 27th chapter of Revelation. It should be great.